Hi, and welcome to Groundwork. This podcast is going to be on the different types of shelters. My name is Jean Allert, and I'm the founder and executive director of the Samaritan Women. Before I get into the podcast, let me preface this by saying that over the last 5 years, we have observed that there are organizations starting shelter programs for victims of human trafficking in the United States, but there doesn't seem to be a structure or framework for us to be able to distinguish the different types of housing programs or anti-trafficking victim services programs that are available. What we'd like to put forward in this podcast is just our idea of what a framework might look like so that we could distinguish quite literally between apples and oranges within our industry. So I'm going to say again that this is just our proposal of what could be constructed as an overall framework of the different types of agencies that are needed to deal with the problem of victim services. Also, before we begin the podcast, I'm going to recommend to you that you download the PDF that is on our website that corresponds with this particular podcast. It's going to be called Types of Agencies. That graphic will be helpful as we go through this particular recording. So now that you've done that and had a chance to put that document in front of you, let's just go through and narrate the different types of agencies. Starting from the left-hand side, I want to go over and I want to talk about what's the purpose of each of the different types of agencies and what distinguishes them in terms of the type of work that they do and the objective of that type of agency. What, in broad strokes, might be the duration of care? Are there any impact or considerations to the location of that agency? Who's that agency serving? What's the disposition of the clientele? And what do we need to consider about the clientele that may be served by that type of agency? And then any other considerations either about the population or the particular services that might be offered. The first one is the anti-trafficking organization. Now, this might be called a coalition or a task force, but this is not what we would say falls into the category of a victim services organization. These are often community-based, meaning they are tied to a particular geography, and their goal is to promote social change by increasing the community awareness of the issue of human trafficking, building a unity of service providers, and a coordinated approach to the prevention, prosecution, penalties, and service provisions in a given community. Their work can be chartered to be a limited duration, but most of the ones that we see tend to have ongoing charter, meaning they're going to keep working until the work is done. And most of us know that's going to be a long time. Their impact, as I mentioned, is identified by their geography. So you might see a coalition that is just for a city, or you might see a task force that is for a particular region or at the state level. That's really going to depend on who is heading up that coalition or that task force. The client disposition and considerations are left blank because largely the clients are the different agencies that compose that task force or that coalition. So if you brought together domestic violence shelters, hospitals, Department of Education, Human Rights Commission, local government, elected officials, law enforcement, to create that multidisciplinary approach, each other is really the customer or the clientele. And the services are focused oftentimes on providing information to the public or specific industries. When we get into the further categories of agencies, this is where we're talking more about victim service providers. And the first one in that umbrella would be the outreach. Now, this is generally where the individuals involved in some kind of an outreach have identified a venue. So take a look at impact of location. Oftentimes the agency doesn't have a direct footprint. It's not like it has an office or a storefront, but it may. The target is a particular venue of trafficking. So for example, there might be an outreach effort targeting strip clubs or brothels, or it might be a track where there's a lot of street prostitution in an area. These can often be organized by volunteers. It might be a subset of another agency, perhaps an anti-trafficking agency. And their objective is to create relationship with individuals who are still actively within the trade. And so they are literally out on the streets or going into the clubs, and they may have just a few minutes to interact with somebody who is currently engaged in this type of industry. So it's very relational. We have to consider that the clients themselves might be under scrutiny. So in some situations, this might be slightly dangerous work. If you're going out in the middle of the night to work a particular track and to extend things like food, toiletries, small gifts, to offer safety, perhaps protection. So the outreach initiative can vary wildly based on what's happening in your particular community. The next one is the drop-in center, and these organizations often do have a physical footprint, meaning they're going to have someplace where they're located. There's a clear address there. They often are only serving clients within a walking distance, and I'll elaborate on that. Their goal also is to create relationship, but the difference between outreach and drop-in is you're going to them in the outreach, whereas the clients are coming to you in the drop-in center. Depending upon the services that are being offered in a drop-in center, which might include food, clothing, showers, first aid, referral to other services, might be some basic services like helping them get identification, helping them get checked into rehab programs. You're really creating relationship here. You're providing some need that they have that's imminent, but you're also engaging in conversation and hopefully building a level of trust so that they might take advantage of other services that you have. Many people who operate drop-in centers will say that their goal is to get the individual to make the commitment to leave the life by building that trust, creating relationship, and having them avail themselves of the services that you offer. You might only have a few minutes or a few hours. One of the important considerations, though, about running a drop-in center is even though these can be very structured and limited in terms of the services that we offer, you have to consider it's really the client that is in control of that relationship. They're highly variable, and so you may get people who come in intoxicated or high. You might get people who are actively working. You might get people who are looking to escape a situation. But the client is in control because they're the one that's chosen to come to your location. They've chosen to engage with you for something. They might be there just to get cold water or a sandwich or to take a shower. But when they want to leave, they leave. So it is important that they maintain that sense of control because that's part of the foundations of building trust. This can be very hard work, in particularly because the clients are so variable. You may want to be building a relationship, but you may only see somebody one time. Or you may see the same person over and over again, or they drop out for a while and they're very inconsistent. And that can be emotionally taxing on the workers in the drop-in center. The next category of agency is emergency housing. Some people refer to this as a safe house. The goal of a safe house is basically to diffuse the threat. Oftentimes, safe houses are established and work in conjunction directly and closely with law enforcement. And so there's a high degree of control over what is happening within the safe house environment and how these are utilized. Safe houses often are available just for a short period of time, maybe 24 to 72 hours. The purpose is to take somebody out of a situation of imminent threat, to give them a secure area where we can frankly learn more about the individual and the nature of the threat so that law enforcement and other service providers can determine the next course of action. We have to keep in mind that the client in this situation is going to be highly volatile and probably a high flight risk. So this is not necessarily the time to come in with a lot of, shall we say, do-gooder intentions, because the individual may not necessarily be receptive. He or she may be very fearful of what is going to happen to them if they return to the life, what is going to happen to them if they get arrested, what's going to happen to them in terms of being moved to another placement. And so we have to expect a hypervigilance, and perhaps not all of their responses may be fully truthful. That's just the nature of where they are in this particular stage of the process. The location oftentimes is undisclosed, and again, so this may be working very closely with law enforcement. So unlike a drop-in center where people are going to know that location, it's seldom that you will know where the emergency housing is located. Their services often are just in the realm of basic needs. What's needed within that finite window of time to care for the person and keep them stable until the next course of action can be determined. If you are interested in getting into the safe house type of work, we would recommend that you approach law enforcement, either at the federal or at the state local level, again, because that's going to be probably your primary customer for using that particular, offering that type of service. So now let's move into different types of housing, because up until now, we haven't really talked about housing in the way that sometimes people use the word shelter. I'm going to stay away from the word shelter again because I think that it's getting used too broadly in our field, and I want to focus now on three different types of housing. The first is short-term housing, and here we're seeing a lot of different language cropping up. It could be transitional housing, short-term housing, or a new breed coming in, the assessment center. The purpose of the short-term housing is you have an individual where you need to provide some level of immediate and short-term care, but the ultimate goal is to determine that person's greater need and their readiness to take advantage of additional services. So that's probably where the concept of assessment center is fitting in nicely. The duration of short-term housing might be for a couple of weeks. Generally, we see a lot of organizations settling on about a 30-day stay. And these can be in extended stay hotels, might be in an apartment, might be in a residential home. We have to keep in mind that the individual who's moving into the short-term housing might still be ambivalent about whether or not they're ready to leave the life, whether or not they're really ready to trust you, whether or not they even can believe that they could have a new life. They may be undecided and still could be quite a flight risk. Sometimes they're under legal pressure to be in a transitional or short-term housing. It could be that law enforcement is putting them somewhere for a while to determine whether or not they can build a case against the trafficker. So you have to keep in mind that that individual is still very in the mindset of being vulnerable. We may also find that the individual can be very self-sabotaging. It could be good for a while to take advantage of the food and the clothing and the safe place to sleep and the opportunity to shower and to talk to nice people. But in his or her mind, they may still be racing in trying to figure out what their own next plan is. Because in a couple of weeks or 30 days, they really haven't built a foundation of trust with you. Now here, it's important that the control is highly in the hands of the program. And I don't mean that in any kind of oppressive way. What I mean is here's where structure is going to be very, very important, because that's also part of building trust with the individual. They have to believe that if food is going to be there tomorrow, or nobody's going to hurt them while they're sleeping, or that they are safe walking around the grounds. They have to be able to trust what you promise as part of that program, because it's a big part about building the foundation for what they're going to be able to do and accept going forward. So here's where it's especially important to not make a promise you can't keep. Your services have to be safety above all and a consistent provision of their basic needs. You might be able to introduce some level of legal assistance, and that might be things like coaching them through the legal process if they are placed there by law enforcement. It's a great opportunity to bring in some spiritual assistance, and this might be just somebody who's a good pastoral listener to them. We do not recommend that this is a time to force them to do a bloodletting of their story, but just giving them that precious opportunity to be heard in whatever it is that they're ready to talk about. And here's where community is very important. They need to see consistent people. They need to know that they are reliably there. If you say you come every Tuesday, you need to come every Tuesday. Because again, this is all about promises made and promises kept at this stage. The short-term or assessment center agency can also be extraordinarily helpful in making referrals to long-term placements or making a determination about whether or not this individual has the capacity and the resources to return to their geography, return to their family, if that's even possible, or if they have to move on to some other kind of long-term care, whether that is restorative housing or whether or not at the assessment center you've determined that their mental health needs or their medical needs are so acute that they're going to have to go into a different type of care. So here's where, in terms of staffing, which I realize I don't have on the list here, but here's where we would recommend that you have a long list of service providers that you can tap into if you need them, but you don't necessarily have them on payroll. So make sure that there is a reservoir of clinical people that you can tap into, a psychiatrist, clergy, individuals that you can bring in as you need to for each individual survivor. The next category is long-term housing. There are far fewer of these across the United States. Our organization, the Samaritan Women, is one that fits into this category. We like using the term restorative housing because it makes clear what it is that we're trying to do, which is to restore the individual back into society. Our goal is to rehabilitate the life so that they are able to be as functioning and productive within society as he or she may be able to be. What I see across the United States is that most of the programs who fit into this category are about a year to 18 months in duration. Ours is 2 years. There are a couple of other programs like that that are 2 years. And some of the restorative programs for minors can be up to 7 years. The location varies wildly. Oftentimes I get asked the question, does the housing need to be out on some remote pastoral farmland so that they're sort of a million miles from anywhere, thinking, I guess, to reduce the amount of threat. But it's been our experience that by the time an individual gets to the restorative tier of program, that the threat really has been dissipated, and it needs to be in order for that person to focus on healing. So while sometimes it can be advantageous for you to be out on a large property, consider the pros and cons of also being removed from direct services. What we've learned being located in Baltimore City is that it actually works in our favor to be somewhat removed on a relatively large piece of property so that we can have our campus have a strong feeling of safety. But we're also in the city, so we have access to a wide range of direct services and transportation and recreation and culture, which is all part of bringing individuals back into society. It also gives us access to a deep reservoir of volunteers, which we use extensively. Now, by the time an individual has reached long-term housing, they may still be quite anxious, but it shouldn't be about the threat per se. It should be more about she cannot yet envision her future. And that's fine. Depending upon how long she has been in exploitation and abuse, it may be hard for her to envision what a new life might be like. She should sincerely be desiring a change, even if she's uncertain about what that change may look like. What we look for more than anything in terms of candidacy is she committed to change and is she willing to do whatever it's going to take to have the life that can be new for her? In terms of the issue of control, here's where we want to make an important point. We believe that it is essential that referral come into our program and understand that there is very clear structure. And that structure is not so legalistic as much as it is to teach the relationship between action and consequences. She needs to oftentimes be taught again that what she chooses has consequences, negatively or positively. That if the program is working well, the control starts with the program, meaning we're providing the structure and how the day is going to go and what programming and what's expected of her. But over time, the longer she stays with us, that control needs to shift over to her. She needs to take on more and more of her own agency and decision making. And we would advocate that for anybody who is in the long-term or restorative line of work. The real challenge about doing this kind of work is that in the area of services and resources, the list can go on forever. Oftentimes people ask me, what services do you offer? And I say, everything. It really depends on what she needs. Certainly safety, basic needs are very, very important. He or she might be working on and must be working on eliminating some of the barriers in her life, and those might be legal or financial. We do a great deal of work spiritually to help her reframe her identity and also the way in which she sees her traumas within the context of a larger story, and then also building out a spiritual community that can be an emotional support to her. Here's where we also begin to invest in her academically, giving her resources based on where she is. So whether she has a third grade education or a college degree, we want her to be able to plug back in academically and become a lifelong learner. We tend to delay the investment in vocation. I know that there are some programs that put people into jobs or they have an existing industry and they get them productive right away. I'm very interested in those programs, but what we choose to do is actually delay her getting a job until she has built more of a basis of accomplishment in other areas of her life, relationally, spiritually, socially, in terms of building up hobbies and other areas of generativity before we tie that to money making. But we do have a vocational program, and again, I know that there are other models across the United States that have robust vocational education programs. So I hope that we will continue to share some of those success stories. The last tier is in the area of, I'll call it graduate housing, because I don't know that that's really emerged well yet in the landscape. But here we're learning that individuals that have been in a restorative program, let's say he or she has been in a program for a year, they've begun to amass some skills, they've stabilized, they've got good coping strategies, they're building community, but they still are not ready to completely leave the supportive community that they have established. And so what we're finding, because we take referrals from all over the United States, is that after a year or more, she really begins to decide that she wants to just stay where she is as opposed to moving back to whatever state she might have originated from. So graduate housing is an opportunity to allow them to advance in their own independence. They take on more responsibility, might include paying rent. It might include establishing something like a small house where you have three or four graduates who all agree to live together for some period of time, might be a few months or multiple years. And they are helping one another, but they may also still stay connected to your restorative program, either as mentors or volunteers. They may support you in some capacity. Again, they're growing in responsibility, but they're still in need of that social connection, which has become so vital. As most of us know, one of the key tenets of trafficking is isolation, and so we have to invert that by fueling their development of community. The control is largely with the client in this case, but we cannot overlook the need for them to have personal accountability. That might be through sobriety groups or checking in or the ways in which they're giving back to your program. You might still offer drug testing, or you might still offer some particular services. That could be job readiness or coaching for those who have moved on to the graduate housing. So that's a very quick overview using the model on the PDF document to give you an idea of how different categories of agencies could emerge. Just want to make a couple of other comments. It's our contention that it is not necessary that there be every one of these types of agencies in every location. Depending upon the nature of trafficking that you have in your area, it might be more important for you to have a number of drop-in centers strategically planted around the city that are serving different clientele in different geography. But then you can refer out to a smaller number of short-term housing or transitional programs. The short term might be organized by demographic. You would have a short term for minors that might be different for males, or you might have a different program for labor trafficked versus those that have been sex trafficked. And then the long-term housing really can be more of a, what we refer to as kind of an underground railroad network of housing across the United States. It has been our experience that the women referred into our program from outside of the Mid-Atlantic area or outside of Maryland specifically do extraordinarily well when they come here. If somebody has made a commitment all the way from California to come to the East Coast, she sees in many ways that she has made a profound commitment to herself and her healing. She also knows that she's moved herself far away from the center of her trafficking, from the center of her bad relationships. And she also knows when she gets that itch about wanting to go back or maybe reconnecting those toxic relationships, that she's going to have to put a lot of a plan and resources in place in order to get back into that kind of life. And so we find that relocation is often a significant aid in their healing process. That may not be true for your experiences, but it certainly has proven true for us. So we really like the model of being able to refer out. And if we have a survivor that's not doing particularly well in our geography because it's familiar to her, we want to be able to have a network of shared partners that we can refer out to and get her located elsewhere so she can really focus on herself. So that's our overview of the different types of agencies. We would definitely be interested in hearing what your experiences have been and what additional details or qualifiers you might have on these different categories. I hope this podcast has been helpful to you and that you will continue to take advantage of the different podcasts that we'll be posting here on this webpage. So, on behalf of the Samaritan Women and our groundwork effort, I thank you for joining us and I hope that you will continue to stick with us in doing this groundwork. God bless you.
Thank you for listening. Learn how to subscribe to our groundwork series by visiting our website at www.thesamaritanwomen.org.